You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome to the program, everybody. Happy Wednesday. Maybe there's some optimism in the air. Maybe people are thinking we can open up soon. We'll talk about that today. The virtual parliament is sitting, and they're going to pass, probably not today because the Senate's not sitting till tomorrow or on Friday, the $9 billion supports for students. You know, the $1,250 for summer jobs from May to August, or $1,750 if you're taking care of a loved one, or up to $5,000 if you're volunteering on a front line. And there's questions about who's eligible and what the new jobs are. They're going to create 76,000 new jobs. So there's a lot out there. But we covered that 6 days ago. They're going to try to debate that and legislate it. But something I want to open with today. As we get deeper into this, and Stats Can release some startling numbers today that we will also talk about how brutal this has been on businesses. How brutal. How many are suffering? How many are changing their models? How many may not make it? How many are innovating? There's enormous pressure to reopen the country because of that, and I understand that. By the same token, you know, the United States has now had more deaths from coronavirus than in the Vietnam War, 10 years of the Vietnam War, 8 weeks of coronavirus. We have a memorial to the men and women who died in the Vietnam War, 58,000. We're past that for coronavirus. So, hey, let's not think that we're out of the woods yet. And in Canada, the numbers are not stopping. Now, they're flattening, but they're not stopping. So it's hard to figure out. And a lot of people tell me, you know what, I feel helpless. What can I do? I'm helping grocery shop. I'm self-isolating. I'm doing my bit. And it's hard to figure out what the hell is going on. I spoke to the former foreign secretary of the UK, a guy named David Miliband. Miliband now is the head of something called the International Rescue Committee, which is the IRC, which was started in 1930s by Albert Einstein in New York to work in the most fragile, difficult countries. And he said that their modeling that's coming out of not only the WHO, but in Britain from the Medical Association of Britain, is that in the 34 most fragile countries in the world, war zones, refugee camps, places like Syria, they think the peak will happen later in May. They think 1 billion people could be affected and 3 million people could die because they can't social distance, they don't have the ventilators. He said in some countries, like the Central African Republic, 3 ventilators in the entire country, 3. They can't, so they need hand washing stations. And so people are confused because it's an overwhelming issue. And so what's happened in the midst of this is, what can you do? You know, you can what? You can stay home. You can eat more French fries to support potato farmers. We're going to talk about that later because that's what they're asked to do, not only in Belgium, but here in Canada. But then what happens is, in the midst of this genuine sense of helplessness that we all feel, there are troubling signs that some people are seizing this helplessness and saying, you know what, this is too complicated. I don't want to blame our governments. What I want to do is find a scapegoat. And there's 3 ways they do this. And it's troubling to me because people are looking for a simple, reduced, graspable way to have some power over this, to get some perspective, to find someone to blame so they can kind of, this is like squeezing water. So this invisible enemy, the virus, whatever you want to call it, is so tough to understand and appreciate, and our frustration's growing and our sense of helplessness growing, that the first things you do is you grasp onto things. So the first thing is false hope. There are those who are grasping onto false hope, latching onto miracle cures like hydroxychloroquine or warm weather or dousing yourself with vitamin C. Those don't work. People that are spreading that stuff are snake oil salesmen. We know that. I hope they work. I wish they work. There's just no, the science is slow. We need a vaccine. We need testing. But in the, and maybe one of these miracle cures will work. My God, I would love it if they did. I'm not dissing it. If someone comes up like they discovered penicillin by accident, my goodness, I would absolutely love it. But these are false hopes so far. So you got to be careful of, you know, those emails that tell you what the false hope. The second thing is scapegoating, and that is happening a lot. You hear the Chinese have released the virus from their lab in Wuhan. There's no evidence of that. It's been investigated. The CDC, the Americans, the Brits, the Canadians, no evidence of that. I know you've heard it. It's bogus. If it was true, we'd cover it. It's not. You have leaders like conservative candidate Derek Sloan asking if Canada's chief public health officer, Dr. Theresa Tam, quote, he asked, does she work for Canada or the Chinese? Come on. I tweeted at him and he said, it's a rhetorical question. What a bogus rationalization. It's not a bogus. You can't say, do the Jews own all the banks? Just a rhetorical question. Of course they don't, but you know, I'm just floating it out there. That kind of dog whistle stuff is a way to find someone to blame. Now look, can you criticize Dr. Tam's decisions? You know I welcome that. And I will play you an interview I did last night with the health minister, Patty Hajdu, and I push hard on did they overtrust the information coming out of China. Criticism, welcome. Scapegoating, not. And then you get other things. There was a story that conservative member Michelle Rempel is living with her husband in Oklahoma, and it's gone viral. Why? Who cares? Maybe her constituents will care. That's her constituents' business if she's serving her constituents well. But do you care in a virtual parliament where a member of parliament is isolating and if they're isolating with their loved ones? Why is that such a popular story? It's popular because it's easy to grasp. Oh, she's not there. Oh, she's criticizing the government. Well, she took off. Why? Do you really want to dig into the personal reasons why an MP is with their loved ones out of the country? Come on. She married an American. So what? Millions of people do. This is a way of deflecting from complexity and finding something cheap and easy to grasp onto because it allows you to have an instant reaction, a hot take when there is no hot take. The hot take is this is long and bloody complicated. But people will find these little stories, find someone to blame, and the worst case now is Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, who just tweeted out this. I mean, I was stunned. I was sickened. I was horrified. There was an Orthodox Jewish funeral in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where a lot of Orthodox Jews and a couple hundred people showed up. And Bill de Blasio decided to tweet out, and he said very specifically in his tweet to members of the Jewish community. This is what he said. To members of the Jewish community and other communities, stay inside. Really? Why would you single out the Jewish community? You know there's a long history of blaming Jews to pandemics going back to the Black Plague. It's a disgraceful thing to single out people. Did he single out the people that were watching the Army and Navy flyovers to honor frontline workers in New York? And all the photos show they weren't respecting social distance. Where was that tweet? Don't generalize. Don't generalize. Don't scapegoat. Why they do that and why people like de Blasio are doing that sloppy, dangerous thing is because this is getting so complicated. People need someone to blame. We must avoid this with all our hearts. Criticize. Don't blame. Critique. Don't scapegoat. I know it's tricky. All right. When we come back, Dr. Theresa Tam's going to give us the latest. And we'll talk about the CFL, should they be bailed out.
Welcome back to the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to our program, everybody. Okay. Two important things. Dr. Theresa Tam has the latest update. And again, what are you listening for? You're going to get the numbers. But is the curve flattening? Are our hospitals overwhelmed? And is this the ticket to open up? And the reason I say this is because businesses are watching these so closely. And Travis Stratton is the chief economist and vice president of policy at the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. He's going to listen into this. They've got a new study out with StatsCan on the impact of the coronavirus on the on Canadian businesses. It's brutal. It is brutal. So we'll reveal that. Here's Dr. Theresa Tam.
As usual, I will start with the latest numbers on COVID-19 in Canada. There are now 50,373 confirmed cases, including 2,904 deaths. To date, labs across Canada have tested over 758,000 people for COVID-19, with about 7% of these testing positive. Yesterday, we had an update on the progress that Canadians have made in flattening the curve of COVID-19. We also looked at some of the short-term predictions from our real data forecasting models. Things are looking better, but we're not entirely out of the woods yet. We have to remain mindful that our projections are only as reliable as our actions now and going forward. If we maintain measures that keep the growth rate down and prevent a rebound, we stand the best chance of remaining on this favorable trajectory. With these promising signs, we are increasingly hearing of reopening plans, but this won't happen at the same time or in the same way everywhere. We've seen that the epidemiological picture in Canada, with slowed growth and bending of the epidemic curve, is actually a composite of very different regional outbreaks and different drivers of COVID-19 spread, depending on where you are in the country. Some areas are seeing very few or no recent cases and have started their gradual social and economic reopening. At the same time, all areas of the country know that there is still a need for key public health practices like physical distancing when we are out or in the workplace and good hand washing always. The ability to maintain these preventive practices is an important part of reopening plans for workplaces, schools and businesses. The critical public health capacity that must be in place and maintained across Canada is necessary to ensure adequate testing to detect, alert, and respond quickly to any new disease activity. Local, provincial, and territorial level plans for reopening are key to managing this next phase. These plans are based on public health criteria and balance the effectiveness of public health measures against their potential negative consequences. Likewise, these measures will need to remain flexible and adaptable to alerts and signals. Although we will be living with COVID-19 for the foreseeable future, we also know that together we can keep this virus at bay by remaining vigilant. Our collective efforts have already slowed the growth of COVID-19, bent the curve, and enabled our health system to cope. These are no small feats, and they tell us we will get through this. Ça va bien aller. Thank you. Merci.
Okay, that's Dr. Theresa Tam. So that's the big picture. Trevin Stratton, Chief Economist and VP of Policy at the Canadian Chamber of Commerce, joins us. And Trevin, I hope you and your loved ones are well. You've got this incredibly interesting survey about businesses. Everyone's watching what Dr. Theresa Tam and our public health officials are saying because they're wondering when the heck we can reopen. What are you guys finding how businesses have been coping with this unprecedented shutdown?
I mean, businesses are seeing taking a huge hit right now. For the survey results that we released today, we had over 13,000 respondents from businesses across the country, and over half of all businesses are seeing a decline of 20% or more in revenue. Just under two-thirds of businesses are highly impacted by lower demand. It's a pretty big hit, and this certainly is in line with some of the data that we've seen coming out from Statistics Canada over the previous weeks, too.
Give us a sense. Some businesses are failing. This is the tragedy. Some are innovating. Some are holding firm. Can you dig into the data and give us a sense of what these 13,000 businesses have said?
Yeah, I think something that's very important that's coming out of the data is that we're really at this crucial period right now where businesses are really on the threshold of making decisions or even being able to be in operation anymore. Kind of over the next 2 to 6 weeks, a lot of businesses are reporting that this is where they meet the point where their revenue starts to run out, where they can no longer remain partially or fully open amid social distancing measures. And so it really speaks to the value of some of the measures that have been put in place to help with liquidity, like the wage subsidy and the emergency business account, but also the need to get that money out as quickly as possible, and also the need to fill in the gaps in some of those programs as well for businesses that are falling through the cracks that might not be able to apply. But you're right, for the businesses that can, They certainly are showing an incredible ability to adapt and to remain resilient while they're coping with this. So a number of businesses have altered their methods of production, altering products or services, using new methods to interact with customers. Obviously, a lot of businesses are testing out working from home and testing e-commerce, as a lot of consumers and individual Canadians are experiencing right now, too. And so, you know, that certainly points to the flexibility of the business community and their ability to step up during this crisis and to adapt much more quickly to the crisis than some governments in some cases, too.
Yeah, businesses said before COVID, they were asked, how much money do you have to survive? 42% said they couldn't operate longer than 60 days without some source of revenue. 51% couldn't operate longer than 90. And 81% have experienced a medium to high drop in demand for services. So going into this, no one's ready for this. I appreciate that. Do businesses say that the government aid packages that are costing hundreds of billions of dollars, have they made a difference?
I think one of the important points to keep in mind is that the survey results are really at the leading edge of when these Right. social distancing practices came into place. So we haven't seen the full impact yet. Certainly, you know, we're seeing the wage subsidy, for instance, the application process being open this week and money starting to come out, you know, by the end of next week as well. But, you know, if a number of businesses, 42% say they couldn't operate longer than 60 days without a source of revenue, well, we're 1.5 months into this crisis right now. So we're getting very close to that. You know, part of it certainly speaks to the need for speed and getting that money out. But part of it is also just improving those programs, too. What is maybe useful is that some businesses, almost two-thirds, about 62%, say that they can return to a state of normal operations within 1 month of the social distancing measures being removed.
Interesting.
And that's hopefully promising. But we should also keep in mind that it might be a phased approach of reopening the economy too. So that might have an impact on those numbers as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's incredible. Like already, in terms of what you guys call the resiliency of business, 18% have offered their methods of production, 35% altered products or services. 45% are using new business methods to interact. 44% have tested working from home. Like 12% are testing e-commerce. It's really interesting. The whole business world is undergoing a accelerated transformation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you know, some of these measures will be short term, but some of these might be longer term changes, both in terms of business practices and business models, but also in terms of consumer preferences and how consumers adapt as well. And so we'll start to see, you know, which ones of these potential changes end up sticking once it comes time for recovery.
Well, listen, a fascinating study, but let's be candid. Resilient, innovative, but bloody worried. I think that's fair to say. Businesses are worried. People that work, small and medium-sized businesses are the biggest employers in our country, folks, and it's tough. How long can this go on? When will you start going out? When will you start shopping? Big questions. Trevin Stratton, great to have you here, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Evan.
That's Trevin from the Canadian Chamber of Commerce. That new study, just absolutely fascinating to see how businesses are responding. We got to know. I always want to just say that you know, when we talk about businesses responding, that's people's lives. That's their jobs. All right. A lot of you have wanted to know, put Patty Hyde, the health minister, on the spot. Did we respond too late? Did we listen to the WHO? Are we skeptical enough about China? I ask all those questions to the health minister, Patty Hyde, next. You don't want to miss that next on The Evan Solomon Show.
This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show. Did Canada act too slowly? It's not too late to ask that. And I spoke to the health minister, Patty Hyde, on CTV's question period. And I asked her, look, the provinces are starting to open up. Quebec is going to send elementary kids back to school in some areas May 11th. If you had a kid in primary school and you lived in Quebec, I began our conversation. Would you send your child back to school in 2 weeks?
Well, thanks, Evan. First of all, I'll just say that provinces and territories are working with the federal government on an agreed set of principles that will help guide those decisions about who will do what and when. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you've asked me a direct question, would I send my child back to school? It would depend on the school, and it would depend on the process in the school in terms of protecting my child from the risk of contracting COVID-19. We know that the outcomes are not as severe for children, but we still don't know necessarily yet whether or not they are effective spreaders of the disease. So all of those kinds of factors would be running through my mind as a parent, and I would be actively engaged in having conversations with my school's administrative team as well as my son or daughter's teacher.
Yeah, Minister, you know, you say the federal government's working on guidelines, but the provinces are already leaping ahead. Some have a calendar date like Quebec. Some have benchmark dates like Saskatchewan and Alberta, or rather Ontario. Will provinces be forced to rework their plans to reopen if they don't comply with the national guidelines, or does the federal government even have jurisdiction to do anything about it?
You know, I think it's very important that provinces and territories consider the shared principles and guidelines, because in fact, what we've seen from other jurisdictions is if we don't have the health and safety fabric strong in each jurisdiction, then there is always a risk of resurgence. And that is even worse for the economy in the long run, in our perspective.
The Prime Minister talked about we need 60,000 tests a day. And he said there might not even be a vaccine ever. We're really far from 60,000 tests a day. When will we hit that benchmark, which seems critical?
Well, it's been great to see the level of work that's been happening at all of the provincial and territorial levels to increase their capacity to test, increase their lab capacity to find the results of the tests that they're gathering. And that's all going to make a big difference, because in fact, it's not just as simple as getting the tests, it's having the capacity to process those tests. I think we're at the average of about 20,000 a day now. And, you know, we've got a ways to go, that's for sure. The work that we're doing in your earlier clip on validating new tests and new test capacity through innovative point of care testing, for example, is all going to make a big difference.
Minister, there's been a lot of criticism on the data that came out of the WHO and from China, especially that Canada trusted the WHO and that the WHO trusted China too much. Even Dr. David Naylor, who your government has appointed to lead a key committee researching a vaccine, said this cost us 2 to 3 weeks in preparation. Will you join other countries like Australia, the United States, France, and call for an investigation into how China handled the data and were they transparent?
I think, you know, we recognize, first of all, the value of an organization like the World Health Organization to be able to have an international response to issues of public health and new outbreaks of new diseases. Having said that, I know that the WHO itself is interested in having a post-pandemic review. Minister Gould spoke with Dr. Tedros just the other day, agreed that it would be of critical importance to be able to review the World Health Organization's response to the emerging disease out of China and its advice to international communities like and countries like ours. So we will look forward to that work. But listen, Evan, I'll just finish my statement. We're in the middle of Canada's outbreak. It's extremely important that we retain our focus and our energy on getting Canada through this first wave and having the social and a health safety network in place to live with COVID.
But to be candid, a lot of, you can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. Australia is doing it. We have now closed all sorts of borders internally and externally. But on February 17th, you said that the suspension of flights to and from China and closing the borders, and I'll quote you, was not effective at all as controlling the spread of the disease. You also said in the long term, they create a greater risk to public health. You also praise China as being very open. Were you wrong about that, Minister? And I think it's important to know that because we still got a long road ahead.
Well, I think, you know, the praise that I offered China in the early days was based on their historic containment efforts. Don't forget there were, you know, multiple millions and millions of Chinese people under essentially confinement, if you will, for a very long time. In fact, in some of those cities, people are just getting back to normal. And that was a public health measure that had never been seen before. Those containment efforts ultimately failed. And, you know, I will point to the fact that I I stand by the remarks on that I made around borders. I mean, listen, we now have stronger measures on our borders. It became very clear that other countries did not have a good handle on what their outbreaks were looking like, including countries like Iran and Italy, who were struggling. And so as the evidence emerged and as we found new challenges, of course, we took new measures based on the public health advice we were getting. And you know what? I am grateful for a country that believes in evolving science.
Listen, I get that too, but you know, and again, I know there's a lot of COVID morning quarterbacking, but we're trying to get a sense of how our government made some decisions. On March 4th, you said borders will become less and less relevant as how we manage this. That actually turned out not to be true. We ended up shutting down our borders. I guess I'm trying to figure out, when did you realize that the WHO advice that you were following was actually not correct? And has there been an accountability and a reassessment of that?
Well, I think there'll be an opportunity to review the international health regulations that actually all countries, members countries of the World Health Organization agreed to. These are regulations that actually mandate, or I shouldn't say mandate, but strictly guide countries in terms of what to do when there is an outbreak. And of course, you know, I think the outbreak that we're facing now is one that we haven't seen in 100 years. So is there an opportunity to review those guidelines? Absolutely. And as I said, Minister Gould had a fantastic conversation with Dr. Tedros, and we remain open to reviewing the actions of the World Health Organization. But I will also reiterate that it's important that we do have a global response, because at some point we will have to resume international travel beyond cargo and essential workers, and we will need to all be working together as a world to eliminate COVID-19.
I get that, but you and I both know that Canada had intelligence reports warning. New Zealand did. New Zealand did not follow the WHO advice because they knew from the SARS experience, which Canada had too, that this was going to be more serious. So they shut down things earlier. But just one last quick question. Today, I just read an article, a report that said after Australia has criticized China and wants to investigate the transparency of China, the Chinese are threatening if they do that, they may stop shipping PPE. Is Canada worried that if we are too critical of China, they will retaliate? Is that why we're being so mute on the subject?
I would just reiterate that this is a global pandemic and that we need to work together with countries all across the world to come up with global solutions. You know, we need to make sure that, of course, that we're being critical about the institutions that serve us internationally, and that we look for ways as we move forward to improve our work together and improve our capacity to prevent pandemics like this. But I will also say that if we don't work together, then we will never be free of this disease, and we will be at risk of even more severe outbreaks in the future.
All right. Your reaction to Patty Hajdu, 71010. Love to hear from you. Did she give you the answer? We'll find out. Coming up next, though, potatoes. The Belgians are urged to eat more potatoes to help potato farmers. So are you. Can you do your bit? Wait till you hear next. The Secretary General of the Belgium potato industry, Belgipom. Next. And the Canadian Potato Council. I can't wait for this. I love my spuds.
Welcome to the Evan Solomon Show.
Is there something you like more than the humble potato? In my view, the potato is the gold medal of vegetables. The root vegetable, the starchy tuber that was first cultivated in Latin America, places like Peru, South America rather, by indigenous peoples. Then, of course, in the 15th, 16th century, moved to Europe. Now it's a staple. I love potatoes, but potato farmers are doing what some milk farmers, dairy farmers have to do. They are running out of places to store potatoes because there's a glut. They're producing them, but with the shutdown of coronavirus, there is tens, hundreds of thousands of tons of potatoes being stored, and we got to eat them or they're going to go bad. So in Belgium, they're actually urging people to eat chips. This is their national dishes, French fries with mayonnaise. twice a week. I could do that. But in Canada, we've also got a big problem. And Bill Zalmans is the chairman of the Canadian Potato Council, which operates WNA Farms in Richmond, British Columbia. They grow all sorts of things. But, of course, Manitoba, PEI, these are big potato areas. And, Bill, first of all, thanks for joining us. And how desperate is the situation for Canadian potato farmers?
Well, we're at a real crossroads here. It's desperate. We've got over 1,000 growers across the country. We got over 341,000 acres of potato production, valued at $1.3 billion in revenue. It's huge. The impact is from coast to coast. There's not one province that has not been hit by this.
And why? And so, what's going on? Like, tell us about how many potatoes you would normally move, but given the shutdown, what's happening?
Well, go back 3 months from today when the first coronavirus came through. We were in a shortage situation of potatoes nationwide. Overnight, we became a surplus. And everything is in storage. The production has been all harvested, last year, so all the buildings are full. Processors are backlogged. They have no room to store. Freezer space is completely full. And food services is a zero. And so we don't have any room to move anything. And where are these potatoes going to go? The storages are full. The farmers have got to plant a new crop. They got expenses to pay. Their revenue is in their product that's in the buildings. And so we've got a bank problem, we got a crop problem, we got a consumption problem, and we got a problem right across the country and across the nation, as you said in your early remarks. In Europe, it's a similar scenario. In the U.S., it's another similar scenario.
And is it because people just aren't going out, that retail stores aren't serving French fries, basically?
Exactly. We're talking 40-45% of the production was to food services and French fries and all around. And yes, potato chips are still happening, but that seems to be the only one that's really going.
What can we do? I'm not like Bill, I'm like every single Canadian. I love potatoes. When I was a kid, the only thing I would eat, I had to go to the doctor because all I would eat was a baked potato. In Belgium, they're literally asking people, Romain Cools, the potato growers union, Belgipom, is saying, you got to eat potatoes twice a week. Should we do that? I mean, listen, man, I can get behind three times a week on this, Bill.
Well, I totally agree. But historically, we always said the caption was, potatoes make the meal. You couldn't have a meal without potatoes in one sort, shape, or form. But today, there's so much diversity. But yes, we would love to see people eat more potatoes. In every province, farmers have been giving potatoes to food banks and trying to help out where needed to help with this. But it's a huge amount of potatoes. And where are we going to go? Who's going to bring the revenue to the grower who is financially now strapped? He's got a crop to put in. He's got seed purchased. Again, it's a chain reaction that goes down. It's just not one barn of potatoes full right now. There's a three-year program in place that comes up to the growth to produce this crop. So in the seed sector, it's a producer. So the general public, yeah, do what you can. Eat more potatoes. Buy that five-pound bag at your grocer. Take them home. It's still one of the most cheapest food items that one can put on the table. And that will really make the meal.
It really will. But let's talk about how things can get worse. And I hate to say this, Bill. My concern is if what happens with these potatoes, how soon are they going to rot in storage or go bad? We all see our potatoes start spudding out under our sinks wherever we keep them. And then what the other concern I have is a collapse in prices. So the growers, you know, the prices were pretty good before this, but the prices could start collapsing with the glut on the market. Then the potato farmers are in trouble.
Correct. So the product that's in storage virtually has a couple of months left of sitting there. But all indications are they're not going anywhere. The processors have said, hold on to them. We're probably not going to be using them. They're your potatoes. Figure it out. they're also kidding the farmer. You've got that mountain of potatoes in your barn. More importantly, we're going to cut back on our contracts 15 to 20% right now. It might be more, which is going to, it's going to cut back, and acreage is huge. Oh, hold it. My revenue was that pile in the barn. My expenses now, how are we going to survive? How is this farmer going to move forward? You're dealing with mental state of farmers that are already working with the weather elements, with the market elements, and being told all these different things. We don't have a lot of time for these potatoes that are in storage. We don't have a lot of time left for the growers to get out and start to plant their crop for this year, because no crop in the ground means no revenue from that. But on top of that, they've already got a certain amount of expenses put down the pipeline for to put a crop in this year.
Right. Well, Bill, hang on. I got Romain Cools on right now. He's in Belgium, and we've just reached him. And this is another sign. I've got a couple minutes left. Romain Cools is the Secretary General of the Belgian Potato Body, Belgipom, and the CEO of the World Potato Congress. Romain, I've been talking to Bill Zylmans, the Chairman of the Canadian Potato Council. How bad is it around the world for potato farmers?
Well, to be very honest, I think that the story in Canada is a little bit similar in Belgium and Europe. Belgium is in the middle of the potato area of Europe with the Netherlands, Germany, north of France, and Belgium. And we are coping with the same problems at this moment. That is, of course, a lack of demand because of the global lockdown of restaurants everywhere. And the only channel which is more or less open is the retail channel, but most of the potato products globally are consumed outside of home. So that remains a problem. And for the farmers itself, it's of course worrying time. For the total value chain it is in Europe, there were some agreements in most countries that farmers could be sure that their contracts which had been made, would be picked up and would be paid correctly. But of course, next to that, in Europe, there's also a tradition of having a lot of free market potatoes, which are not contracted. And this volume, which is more or less 2.4 million tons at this moment, will probably not be processed. And
right.
Of course, everybody, just like in Canada, is holding his heart here, because next season will probably also, which is
guys,
most of our potatoes have been planted. Huh?
I got to take a break, unfortunately. We got to Romain Cools, the Secretary General of the Belgian potato industry. By the way, the World Potato Congress is located in Charlottetown. Romain, I'd love to have you back. Bill, my heart goes out to you. Guys, eat more potatoes. They're delicious. Support your farmers.